friends, and welcome to the National Deer Association's Coffee and Deer Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Pinizzotto, and sitting in for the doctor today is NDA's Chief Marketing Officer, Lindsay Thomas Jr. Now, the doctor had a number of things come up. One of them is deer-related, but I'm sworn to secrecy. I'm going to let him tell the story. It's kind of an unfortunate one, but he'll tell the story next time he's on the show. But LT, I appreciate you stepping in today.
That's some big shoes to fill, Nick, but I'm happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
I'm sure the doctor's listening and probably critiquing you, so no pressure. Lindsay and I were just together in Shepherdstown, West Virginia at the Southeast Deer Study Group meeting. It's something that we do every year. And I got to tell you, Lindsay, the highlight for me was it snowed. And I think it's only the second time in like 20 years that it snowed at this thing. And both times it was in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, ironically. But watching you as a Southerner taking pictures of the snow and all these Southerners and, you know, seeing the Southern Wildlife Agency trucks covered in snow, that was entertaining for me, I have to admit.
Yeah, we don't get to see snow a lot. So, yeah, we take pictures and send them to family when we see that.
Yeah, well, that was just another day in the north for us. But anyway, it was a great meeting as always, and we always get a lot of takeaways from that. So, hey, in this episode, our guest is Matt Light. I'm sure that name rings a bell with our NFL fan listeners. He had an 11-year career with the New England Patriots, 11 consecutive winning seasons. Don't imagine too many people have had that, including 9 division championships, 5 conference titles, and 3 Super Bowls. And made a career out of protecting Tom Brady's backside at left tackle, even blocked for Drew Brees. So I would be taking a lot of credit for their success, Matt, if I was you, because if it wasn't for you, they might not be who they are. But anyway, he's a big time hunter and a deer manager. And also we're going to talk today, him and his wife, Susie, founded the Light Foundation, doing some really impressive, awesome work. So Matt, welcome to the show.
Well, Nick, Lindsay, great to join you guys. And I'll say right out the gate, been a member of QDMA and of course, NDA for a long time. I had the pleasure of having Kip Adams out at our farm a few times over the years and participated in some studies. And man, I got to tell you, it's incredible the work you all do, the information you share, you know, how you bring people into the fold. You know, hats off to everybody in the organization.
Well, we certainly appreciate your membership and your support. Most people don't describe time with Kip as being a pleasure, but we'll go ahead and believe you on that. So Kip's the one that helped set this up. And so, he wishes he could be here. He's actually in Arkansas. But hey, tell us a little bit more about you outside of the football stuff, you know, where you grew up, that type of thing.
You know, I grew up in West Central Ohio, a little town of Greenville. For those that are big fans of Annie Oakley, that's where she that's where she's from. So that's our big claim to fame. And, I grew up in a family that, you know, outdoors was number one, right? Everything we did centered around the outdoors. Our trip up north to our hunting camp up in northern Michigan was something we looked forward to every year. Grew up doing what most kids in the Midwest do. You know, you're chasing rabbits. You know, you got your dogs running coyotes and squirrel dogs. And, you know, it's just I look back on my childhood and, you know, I just wish that every kid could experience, you know, life like that, being around, you know, friends and family. And for me, I guess the added bonus was that, you know, my grandfather was in the Outdoor Writers Association and great grandfather, you know, really created one of the places that is most near and dear to my heart, an area called Wayne Lakes, and took stuff from a American aggregate and big old pits, and it didn't look real pretty when he started, but he turned it into this paradise. So conservation and creating, you know, the kind of opportunities that we love today as outdoorsmen, you know, that started a long time ago in this country, you know, with people that, you know, put, you know, the environment and, you know, conservation first and foremost. And so, you know, I've just been fortunate to grow up around, you know, leaders in the community and through the outdoors and take part in, you know, incredible hunts. And, you know, as I, you know, kind of grew up in that environment, I lost track of it for a while, you know, running around hitting sweaty large mammals playing a game of football. But, you know, nonetheless, you know, here I am many years later, and we get to work with kids through the outdoors. We get to introduce, you know, people to their first hunts. And you know, where I live now is in the space of guiding, butchering. It's less about the hunt than it is the food plots and the preparation and the butchery. And I remember hearing you know, some of the old timers say, hey, you're going to get to a point where, you know, the chase isn't everything. And I think I've graduated to that point.
Yeah, we've certainly had those conversations around here. All of us are kind of a similar age here, and I think going through the same thing. You've alluded to it just a second ago, but I want to ask you this question. So, you know, like most people who played football, I never played it down after high school, but I remember vividly running home after practice, grabbing my bow and running out for like the last 30 minutes of light to try to get a shot at a deer. Now you got, I hate to use the word stuck, but you know, being an outdoorsman, you kind of got stuck in a career where, man, football and hunting don't really get along too well. And you were into your mid 30s before you finally freed yourself from that to get more into the outdoors. Is that agonizing for you?
You know, there were definitely times. I think all of us look at the time in the outdoors and you say, it's your therapy, right? It's your one opportunity to, you know, let everything go that's in your mind, all the stuff you're dealing with, the work or family things or, you know, whatever it is that weighs you down at times. And you take that walk to your stand or you go on that still hunt or you get out on a cold, brisk, you know, winter morning and everything goes away. And I can remember, you know, just wishing that I had more of those opportunities. And, you know, I was able to get out a little bit, but, you know, I think for all of us, especially deer hunters, right, where scent control and how you get in and out of your stand and, you know, all the, you know, the myriad of things that go into being a successful deer hunter, you have to be dialed in. And for me, the thing that I always knew is that I was going in cold. And, you know, yeah, I appreciated getting out a morning or two here and there, but I knew I wasn't doing the work that was, you know, really required. So, you know, it was a struggle, but I did, Nick, turn my attention to turkey hunting because, you know, growing up in the Midwest, we didn't have a bird, you know, anywhere near us. Nobody talked about turkeys. You know, fast forward, you know, about the time I was graduating, you know, from Purdue, I remember thinking, you know, I'm hearing about these turkeys. I'd like to go turkey hunting. And then when I got to New England in 2001, boy, turkeys were everywhere. So right. I was able to turn my attention to that. And that was one of the hunts that I could start and finish, you know, from beginning to end, and just fell in love with that. But, you know, to back up a minute, you know, I had three generations of my family wrote the local outdoors column. So, wow. As much as what football played a role in my life, you know, early on, I tell you, the highlight for me was if my Uncle Bob included me in one of his stories that he would tell through his Lights Outdoors column in a local paper, man, I thought I was the coolest cat on planet Earth. You know, I mean, that was the pinnacle for a kid, you know?
Yeah, that's outstanding. This reminds me, I've had conversations with Trent Cole, who you probably know. Played for the Eagles. You probably played against him a bunch of times, but he's a big outdoorsman. And he would tell me these same things. Like not that he didn't love his profession, but he just couldn't wait to get out and go hunting. And he does that all the time. And I think he's probably a similar age to what you are, but yeah, kind of faced those same things. And I remember having these conversations with him, but yeah, we're going to talk about turkey hunting in a second. And I see you got your turkey hat on. So you're definitely living it there. And how cool is it to have all those outdoor writers, Lindsay? I mean, you're an outdoor writer, professional outdoor writer. Could you imagine being like, you know, third generation of that in your family?
No, that's real interesting. And I was listening to that, Matt. So if I understood right, you said your grandfather was a member of the Outdoor Writers Association and wrote, it sounds like several generations wrote columns. What were those? Tell me more about that, because I'm curious to look those up. And did you say Bob Light? That was your grandfather?
Yes, sir. Yeah. You know, Lindsay, well, Bob was my uncle and James Light was my grandfather. And I think it actually goes back to my great grandfather, this love of writing, you know, columns and my father's a phenomenal writer in his own right. But, you know, I recently downloaded and digitized, I think, the vast majority of all the columns written, you know, by my grandfather and, you know, by my uncle. And I know it goes back to my great grandfather. So, you know, three generations writing for the local paper, and it was the Daily Advocate in Greenville, Ohio. And, you know, you go back and you read what, you know, your ancestors or what people wrote about. And it's the same things that we see today. Right. I remember an article vividly where my Uncle Bob would talk about slob hunters. And that's what he called them back in the day, right? And it's no different than today, right? You know, we have a responsibility as outdoorsmen, and we have a responsibility, you know, to make sure that the message that we send is the right one. And, you know, I love to get a picture from a buddy posting something, but, you know, I always caution everyone, we have to be careful, because it's easy to judge a picture and not the intent, right? And I think back to so many articles that I've read that, you know, my grandfather wrote, that my Uncle Bob wrote, and just this immense respect that they have for the resources that we have in this country. And they're drawing the same claims to, you know, then that we do now today, right? Look at these other countries. You don't have the opportunities that we have here. And to hear them write about that, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, you know, is pretty incredible. And I just think it speaks to, you know, the weight that's on our shoulders as outdoorsmen to tell the right story, to get the next generation in, to teach them how to respect the things that we have here and how to further them, you know, hopefully through great practices.
That's amazing that you have that resource there at your hands, not only the history, their, you know, what they wrote about their hunting and fishing exploits outdoors, but that's part of your family. You know, that's like an heirloom now to you. It's like having a documentation of family members. We all like to study, you know, who where did we come from? Who were our ancestors? Having their writing and seeing their experiences, but also the documentation of their hunting exploits, what was going on in the outdoors, what was wildlife like then, what were populations like, hunting seasons and things like that. So that's, you must be extremely proud to have that as a resource to look at. Did you read them, you know, when you were younger and they were writing columns, did you read those as you were growing up?
Yeah, I mean, like I said earlier, you know, if my name was mentioned, you know, my Uncle Bob would write about taking me and picking me up and taking me out to one of the lakes and, you know, how I'd outfish him. And of course he let me, I'm sure. But, you know, I would look forward to seeing that column, you know, each and every week and seeing where he went. And, you know, look, again, as a kid, in our little downtown, we have this memorial hall, right? Like so many small towns do across the country. And I'll never forget getting to meet a guy named Wally Tabor. And I'm sure you know the name Wally Tabor. A lot of people do. Wally Tabor used to tour all around the country, and he would have these slideshows, and he would show all of these incredible photos, and he would tell the story of where he and his wife went. They were in South America one time catching peacock bass, or they're, you know, in Africa, you know, shooting some crazy creature I'd never heard of, right? And I remember my dad would take me up and introduce me to him. And you know, my father was also very fortunate. My grandfather was good friends with Fred Bear. And they would stop at Fred's place on the way up to our camp in Michigan. And Fred would load him up with a whole bunch of crazy, you know, helical, you know, shafts, you know, all these different arrows that he wanted my dad and my grandfather to test out. And my dad's got a wall of bows that were given to him, you know, by Fred and passed down through the family. So, you know, one of the things that I cherish is that when my grandfather passed away, Fred wrote this incredible letter. And of course we've got that in our collection. And I don't know, I just think that too often we get busy with the next thing, and we don't, maybe not all of us, but in a lot of cases, we don't take the time to stop and look back at those that came before us. And man, there's a lot of information out there, and there's a lot of history, and there's a lot of things that we need to be reminded of. And I think the more we can circulate and champion, you know, those great conservationists of the past, you know, the better off we'll all be.
Yeah, I think anytime I hear a story that starts with Fred Bear, it always gets my attention. And I love that history. And certainly appreciate what he represented and others of that time as well. And it's so cool that was such a big influence in your life. I want to ask you this. So you were blessed to have grown up in sort of Big Deer Central. I lived in Columbus, Ohio for a number of years. I really enjoyed having access to the quality of deer that state brings. And then also in Indiana, basically the Midwest. What was it that got you into or interested in the deer management side? You said that you've been a member of ours for a long time. You've had Kip out to your place. What is it that got you excited about that?
You know, I think for me, you know, I went to Purdue and I grew up with a father who's a world-class engineer. And, I wanted to be an engineer, right? I wanted to follow in my dad's footsteps. And again, I ended up playing this game of football and got out of that world. And once you get out of a certain world, it's real tough to go back. But I've always had an analytical mind, and I look at all the data, right? Let's just focus on cameras, for example. You know, today, it's kind of gross to admit this, but I'm running 50, 60, 70 cameras on a number of different properties. And I mean, I'd like to tell you that I know what's really happening, but there's just, you can't compile that much data, right? So I remember it started for me when cameras were kind of young, you know, like back in the early 2000s. And of course, you know, I was gifted, you know, with, you know, pretty good living, and I was able to buy some land and purchase some of our family lands back that we had up in Michigan. And I'm trying to figure out how to best manage them, right? And I'm running all these cameras, but the reality is I'm not boots on the ground, because I'm running into all these people on the field every day, and I'm relying on this technology, but it's not adding up. I can't compute it all. So for me, I think what started was this need to be able to organize how I looked at these properties and how I was able to get as much done for the very limited amount of time that I would actually have to hunt them. And from there, I started to look for the resources that could give me a much better understanding of how to accomplish what I wanted, what my goals were, right? And started to look into the organization. QDMA was one of the first I found. I found an NDA afterwards, and then I believe it was Caesar Clayburgh. And, you know, people introduced me to great articles and people that were doing studies and all this information that came down the pike, and just started digesting it. And then, of course, fell in love with food plots and how to do rotations and hinge cuttings and CRP programs. And man, the list just never ends, right? And then for me, a lot of that then translated to some opportunities that I had to go overseas. And you go to London and you get outside of London, and you're in a region called the Cotswolds, and you're walking around, and you're looking at ground that's been managed for 1,000 years. Literally for 1,000 years, they've had practices to ensure that, you know, the way that it is today, it will always remain that, and that they can take, you know, great care of it. And then they're great stewards with what they have. They don't have a whole lot of ground, right? So they make sure that they do it right. So, man, it's just this incredible journey. And I think, like anything, the more you get into it, the more you're blown away at what you can accomplish.
Yeah, it's kind of a never-ending circle. And if you own land, which you do, and those listening that own land know, there's never a day where, like, you say, you know what, I'm done for the day. I mean, there's always another tree you can cut or hinge, or there's always another food plot you can improve. And obviously, that's the life that we live here, that you get to see a little bit, always trying to help people figure those things out. So let's transition to turkeys for a second, because as I was driving home from West Virginia, I got a call from Kip, and you must have just got off the phone with him. And he starts telling me this crazy turkey story. And that's when he said, you got to have Matt on to talk about deer. He said, but you got to hear this turkey story. And I know he didn't do it the same justice that you will, but I was flabbergasted. And so I'm just going to turn this over to you, and you can share this story firsthand. So the floor is yours.
Well, Nick, it is a tale. So about 10 years ago, I had a guy that's one of our board members come up to me and say, hey, look, I got this opportunity. We can auction off at our big event. We can auction off this hunt down in Florida. And not being real versed in Florida and kind of had my own idea of what Florida represented, I thought, yeah, okay. So I call the guy and start talking to him. And man, this place is first class. They got a lot of turkeys. It'll time up well. We can auction this thing off. It's a very private place called the Gilchrist Club, about 27, 28,000 acres. And boy, we put this thing in our auction, and we had a group of guys that have been great to our foundation that bought it, raised a ton of money, probably 25,000 for four guys to go down. So I told my friend, I said, hey, you got to come down with me. You know, he's a Gloucester guy, grew up in the city, never saw a camo in his life, you know, never pulled a tick, you know, so I said, you got to come down and hunt, man. This will be your first hunt. This will be epic. And I coached him up a little bit on what to do and how to do it, and got him prepared. And he shows up down in Florida the following March. We auctioned this trip off in September at our celebrity shootout. March comes around and we're all down in Florida and we're having a ball. And my buddy, Jamie, first time hunter, he gets tapped to go chase the ghost of Gilchrist, which is a bird for 2 years they've been trying to kill on this epic, you know, Gilchrist club. And doesn't he shoot it? And of course he looks it up, and not only is it an Osceola, but it's a 44 pound albino Osceola, world record. So the following September, we're auctioning off the same hunt. And I told him in advance of this big event of ours that, hey, look, we raised $25,000. We may raise $50,000 if you get up and tell your story, because that's never been done. And oh, by the way, he had it mounted. It was already sitting in his living room. And he's featured on the cover of Florida Game and Fish. They found out about it, of course, pictures and content that was out there. And he got 200 advanced copies that he was signing at the event the following year for all these people. And then when he gets up on stage, he's telling a story, and boy, he lets everybody know that he killed the Moby Dick of turkey. It's a world record. And that he's the Tom Brady of turkey hunting. So we launched an opportunity for people to watch this epic documentary that gives you all the details on the Tom Brady of turkey hunting and what actually took place. And I guess I'll be a spoiler, but you got to see it to believe it. In front of those 500 people, we watched his video of him hunting this bird, which he missed the 20 yards. But of course, just to let you all know, it was a broad-breasted white turkey that I bought at a farm. And this knucklehead, when I tell you the when you watch this, if there's not tears coming out of your eyes, and you don't have to be an outdoorsman, anybody can see real, and this is as real as it gets. But full circle, we did it because A, Jamie's an amazing sport and he's an incredible board member, but we're auctioning off a trip now for people to win a chance to go down, all expense paid, to go to Gilchrist and not hunt an albino, but a real Eastern, you know, Osceola. You know, so it's one of these things we do through the foundation. This thing will raise a ton of money for the work we do with kids. And it is a funny tale. So I would encourage you, check it out, turkeytouchdown.com, and you'll get to see the epic tale of the Tom Brady of turkey hunting.
We're going to talk about the foundation here in a minute, in that event actually that you're auctioning off now, but I think there's a lot of amazing elements to this story to me. Number one, to be able to keep it going for a year. Like, I can't keep something going for a day, let alone a year. So how did you, like, with a straight face, and you had the Fish and Wildlife Commission involved, and I mean, this is incredible.
Yeah, you know, well, I guess I should say we didn't actually have the fish and game there in Florida involved. My brother called this knucklehead pretending to be the head of fish and game. And I wrote the article and printed off the magazines that he was signing. So I grew up, again, going back to my childhood, my great grandfather started the Liars Club, and it's been something that's still going to this day. It was a bunch of outdoorsmen, actually came from the Outdoor Writers Association, guys that he would take trips with, and they started pulling practical jokes, as we all do, right? And then it turned into a club, and we've seen senators and sheriffs and all kind of people that have joined this club over the years. So I get it, honestly, and I kind of carried it on in my own, you know, tradition, I guess. And, you know, it was amazing. There was a time where I went with Jamie. It was probably about 2 months before our event in September, and we're down in West Virginia at the Greenbrier. And when we leave there, there's a little tiny airport, and Jamie's a salesman, and he's telling this guy that's checking us in about how, you know, there's a lot of wildlife. And the guy's like, yeah, he goes, do you hunt? He goes, yeah, I hunt. He goes, you ever killed a 44 pound albino Osceola? And he hands the guy his phone with the picture, and he's like showing him. And the guy literally says, well, hell, son, we got about 10,000 of them in a barn just down the road. And I'm behind him going, like, and you know, the guy's looking at me kind of funny, and Jamie didn't think anything of it. When Jamie went through security, I grabbed the guy and I said, hey, man, here's the deal. The guy literally fell to his knees because he saw how serious my buddy was. So it was hard to keep secret, but it was a riot.
Now I understand why Kip loved this story so much. Because Kip is the dangerous one among us. Whenever we're together for meetings or whatever, you know, I've literally learned not to believe anything he says on first take. He is, because he's the practical joker among us. I understand now why he appreciated this story.
Yeah, you got to be on your toes around that guy for sure. But so, so he gets the other thing that's killing me here is he gets this thing mounted. So he's all in on this, and then when he finally finds out that it's not real, what was that like for him?
I got to tell you, we're on stage in front of 500 people, right? Oh, I mean, man. We're at the event, and when you watch this video, it is the greatest part of it, right? Like, to me, the setup is awesome. If you know a little bit of the background, that's great. But once we get to the point where we're both on stage, and you can see my face, I'm like looking at the screen, you know, this giant screen that we're up on stage watching, and he's to my right. And whenever it happens, he looks at me and I mean, we lost it. I mean, we're on stage like two little kids, you know, we're just crying. He's hitting me. He had some choice things to call me, but man, he took it well. And you know, it's so funny. Like, I've had people that are a little sensitive, right? You know, like, I mean, I can't believe you did it to your buddy. And I'm like, listen, you know, these are the kind of things where I would never do this to somebody that I didn't love and respect, right? I mean, I think all outdoorsmen can relate to it. There's just this, there's nothing ill-spirited, right? When you have that amount of fun, it's contagious. And immediately he knew how great this was. And boy, we've laughed for a decade about this one.
Yeah. And in the long run, it ends up raising a whole bunch of money too, because now you've got the legend of this turkey. And at the end of the day, it's about helping people, which we're going to jump into here in a second. But I should ask you this at the beginning. How's the hunting been for you? I mean, you said that you've transitioned a little bit. It's more about helping others. I'd love to get you involved in our Field to Fork program sometime down the road. But hunting yourself, I mean, is it things gone well for you? Did you get a chance at some nice deer? The work we do at the National Deer Association wouldn't be possible without the support from partners like Johnny Morris, Bass Pro Shops, and Cabela's, and their customers throughout North America. A grant from the Bass Pro Shops and Cabela's Outdoor Fund is supporting the NDA's national initiative called Improving Access, Habitat, and Deer Hunting on Public Lands, with the goal of improving 1 million acres of federal and state-controlled lands by 2026. This grant is directly accelerating work in this initiative to address forest vigor and access issues in six states. In the end, this will address declines in deer hunter numbers, habitat quality, and hunter access, helping to improve wildlife conservation for generations to come.
You know, I tell you, let's see, I've owned my farm in Ohio for, let's just say, 15 years. And about 6 years ago, and I've been out of football now for a while, right? About a decade. About 6 years ago, we lost a dear friend of the family, a guy that was kind of like a second father to me and grew up with his son and big outdoorsman. I remember when he shot a giant buck, how we all celebrated. And man, I feel like I was on that hunt, right? You know how that goes. And I called him Big Papa, and Big Papa passed away. And at that point, 6 years ago, I had never shot a buck on my farm. So, wow. You know, my rule was, if it's not five, you know, there's no question. There's no drawing on them. I'm not even going to take a, you know, like do one of those. Oh, I'm just going to draw and follow him a little bit. I don't do anything. I let him walk. And man, I've had some giants, if you're talking inches, go by me, but I just didn't judge him to be old enough. And I kicked myself because they died in other places and they were definitely old enough, but you know, hey, you win some, you lose some. So, you know, I'd always passed and never really had a problem with that. I figured at some point I'm going to get an opportunity. And 6 years ago, I told Big Papa's wife, I said, hey, look, I'm going to get one for Big Papa this year. And that was the first buck I shot. And, you know, look, if you're looking at a rack, it was just an average Midwestern buck, but he was a big old brute. And that was an incredible hunt for me. This year, though, I did catch up with my target buck. I've been watching him for a few years. Of course, I named him Mr. Bojangles. And and we only danced one time, but that's all it took. You know, we're now together for forever. And, man, it was an incredible situation. I got close to him during the rut, and then I actually went back during the muzzleloader season. And it was just one of those moments, man, literally with 11 seconds left in the season.
Oh my.
I saw him for the first time with about 50 seconds left. And the craziest part is he walked in front of my camera through a food plot, and I was laying on the ground because the wind wasn't good for any of my sets. And just happened to be, man, showed up at 5:59 and 40 or 20 seconds. I shot him at 5:59 and 49 seconds, and sunset was at 5:30 that particular day. So, you know, you can't make it up. One of those incredible moments. And you know, again, for me, I like to eat them. I'm in the butchering and the food plot and the guiding stage at this point. So he may not eat as well, but he sure was an awesome hunt. And actually was able to harvest a buck on my property in Rhode Island. My family and I moved down to Rhode Island recently, and that was another highlight. But, you know, my daughter shooting her doe this year, that was probably the best of the best. So yeah, it's been a great season, man. I've been blessed to, you know, be able to hunt with awesome people and some great locations and have a lot of fun.
Well, that's what it's all about. And it is interesting too, that these deer that we target, that a lot of times, like you said, you only get to dance once. It might be that one window, that one opportunity. And that's exactly what happened to you. And in the last second. So it's just amazing how many times when you target a particular deer that happens.
Yeah. Yep, I feel very fortunate.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. We always ask our guests for some photos at the end of the show. Maybe that would be one you could send us for our promo. Be cool to see that. But hey, I want to give you a chance to talk about the Light Foundation. It's just very impressive work. Spend some time on your website. I'm always super impressed when folks like yourself make it a point to give back, because that's not something you have to do, but you do it. And we're all thankful for that. So tell us a little bit about that, and tell us about becoming the Tom Brady of turkey hunting.
So, you know, I think, look, I'd never seen an NFL game in my life until I played in one, right? I hadn't watched a college game either. And as I've already noted, you know, our lives were, you know, pre-1800 encampments, they called rendezvous and hunting and, you know, doing all of those activities, camping and the like. And so when I finally ended up in New England in 2001, I was like, man, they're going to figure out that they made a huge mistake and I'm not going to be here long. And, you know, cause it was a little overwhelming. I mean, you know, college was one thing, but the pros, that was a whole different ball game. And Bill Belichick. And I mean, as I was told many times, Light, you don't know if the ball's pumped or stuff, son, you know, and it was just it was a crazy deal. And I remember, you know, 9/11 and everything that happened in that first season. And then lo and behold, you know, here, this team full of misfits, you know, goes to and wins a Super Bowl. And I'm sitting there with my family, you know, season's over. And I'm just like, wow, man, you know, I've got to do something big. And we sat down and I said, hey, look, if you guys are on board, let's take, you know, a lot of what's been given to me and let's do something great. And we formed the Light Foundation. And, you know, over the last 20 some odd years, right, you know, we were official in 2002. So it's been roughly 22 years of serving young people. And we have a camp we call Chenoweth Trails. It's located just outside of my hometown. We bring, there's roughly 7,500 kids that come through, you know, that camp annually. We do a host of different programs. All of this centers under the Light Foundation's leadership umbrella. And we have the Leadership Academy. And we do things like our Light Project, where we get first graders, you know, really jazzed up about reading, like real books. Like, and they're all outdoor based. And we supply all the first grade classrooms with 72 books, just a random number we chose. And, you know, they read these books and then they get to come out and they get to do all these cool, you know, outdoor science-based activities, you know, burying underwear and seeing how they, you know, break down and what critters get in them. And, you know, it's just, it's an amazing program to, you know, programs like Camp Vahokas, where we're working with young men from across the country over a 4-year period where they have to commit, you know, and they have to work hard and they've got to show up and they've got to do community service projects and career educational tours. And then we, you know, we got a football camp sprinkled in there. It's free. And all these programs that I'm talking about are free, right? We have a timber frame camp. It's one of my favorites.
Oh, neat.
We teach kids the art of timber framing, and man, it's amazing to watch that sense of accomplishment shine and how they come out of their shells. And again, it's all about leadership. You know, they got to present, you know, what they did, how they make that mortise, how they form that tenon, you know, how they sharpen that slick and that chisel, you know, like, and they get to put together some awesome projects. And then we've got, you know, a number of other programs that are geared towards just getting kids out of their comfort zone, hold them accountable. Things like our youth turkey hunt. They got to get their application in on time, right? Mm-hmm. They've got to fill out an essay, and that essay is going to be graded. And the top 10 essays make it, or the top 20, depending on the program. So, you know, if people go to MattLight72.com, they can learn a lot about what we do. It's really the people that are doing it, though. You know, I'm blessed to have the people that influenced me in my life when I was growing up. They're the same people working these camps, right? It's my mom, my mother-in-law, my dad teaching kids how to make an atlatl or an arapuka or like any of these crazy things. He's napping arrowheads in front of their very eyes, and they're looking at it going, never seen anything like that before. That's kind of cool. The very people that poured into me are giving up their time to work with these kids. And then, you know, through the Light Foundation, we also say, hey, we can't use this facility. It's about 600 acres. We can't use it every day of the year. So if you're a nonprofit and you're working with kids, whether it's a church youth group or a Pheasants Forever or whoever it may be, if you need this facility, it's all yours, you know, free of charge. So we're an and one for other organizations around the country. So, man, it's an awesome thing. It's the highlight of my summer every year. We leave New England when it's actually nice to be there, and we go to landlocked, mosquito-infested Ohio. But, buddy, that's home. You know, like I said, it's awesome to watch young people succeed, do real things, and work hard.
Yeah, and we'll put a link to your foundation in the show notes for people to check that out and see how to support it. And right now you're actually raffling off the Tom Brady a turkey hunting hunt. Is that right?
Yeah, we got turkeytouchdown.com. So if you want to watch, you know, what it looks like for a first-time hunter to go out and bag a world record albino Osceola, we got a front row seat for you. And, you know, look at the end. We bring it all together. You know, you go to turkeytouchdown.com. Yes, you'll get to see a great film, but you also get to see the work we do with kids through the outdoors. You'll get to see what these youth hunts do, and we can hunt them all day. It's legal to hunt all day during a youth hunt. We don't. We stop at noon so that we can do some real things. You know, where, you know, we can talk to them and educate them and get them to maybe make a wing bone call or, you know, work a conservation project, which they're all required to do. It's a highlight of ours every year. And if you support, you know, what we're doing with this online raffle, the money will go back into helping us continue to do these kind of things. But you may get an opportunity to go down and have an incredible hunt of your own. We've got some great partners, you know, that have joined us, you know, Mossberg and Strut Commander and Quaker Boy and, you know, Hooks Custom Calls. These guys have all been great partners. And you also get to hear from some legends, you know, like the Ernie Calandrellis and Mark Drury. And, you know, we've just got awesome people, Willie Robertson and Mikey Miller. So, you know, they've all chimed in. And those guys are incredible in their own right, what they do through the outdoors. So we're blessed to have a great network.
Yeah, you're doing amazing work, and I think it just says a ton about you and your upbringing that the first thing you're thinking about after winning the Super Bowl is how can you give back to somebody else. And so, you know, thank you so much for that good work. I can't let you go without bringing this up, though, because we brought up 2001, which was your rookie year. And so growing up near Pittsburgh like I did and being a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, I know you're hanging your head here. Don't hang your head. I remember the Pittsburgh Steelers played the New England Patriots 2001 in Heinz Field. It was unseasonably warm. You'll remember that. Here you are starting in that game, by the way, as a rookie at left tackle, which is pretty awesome. And so it's a foregone conclusion that the Steelers are going to win this game. Like, New England's lucky to even be in this spot. The Steelers are the favorite. I spend, which at that time was probably my life savings, like $600 to get a ticket. to go to that game and to sit there and watch you guys, I think, go wire to wire in that game and win it, and then go on to win the Super Bowl was pretty awesome. Hard for me to take, but that had to be, I mean, for you to start your career out like that and go to the Super Bowl and win it as a rookie, pretty awesome. Even though, you know, it's going to stick with me forever.
Man, and listen, I tell you, I've got a lot of respect for certain teams, and Pittsburgh was always one of them. I love any team that comes out and they're hard nosed, you know, they're gritty, you know, they bring all of that, you know, kind of football mentality to everything they do. Pittsburgh's always been that. Steel City, you know, there's an edge, you know, there's a competitive spirit within that area. I actually trained at the UPMC Center.
Oh yeah.
As I was getting ready for the draft. And, you know, I was there when they took down the old stadium. Actually got to witness it. I think I had a few cocktails and we were sitting up high at some place watching it. What a moment, what a city, what a great spot, and what a game. I mean, that game was a wild game. And I can remember, you know, Brady goes out towards the end of the game, you know, he gets rolled up on. In comes Bledsoe,
yep.
Who, you know, damn near died, you know, in our locker room earlier that season. And I actually got rolled up in that game towards, like, on the very last series, and could hardly even make it into the Super Bowl. I had to limp into that one. But, man, great memories. But that's a great city and a great team. They've always had a great team and always had a ton of respect for them.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. And, yeah, it was memorable for me, win or lose, and obviously the historic run that you all had and that you were part of. And so we certainly appreciate you being on the show here. And by the way, folks, that's going to be a wrap on this episode. I want to thank you for listening. If you haven't yet joined National Deer Association, join Matt. Matt's a member. What are you waiting for? We have our basic free options. We have our premium level and our life options. Also, be sure to check out all of our social media channels. Mr. Lindsay Thomas is here. Don't disappoint him. He's the man behind all of that great content that gets put out there. And so do him proud and go check it out. This is getting into food plot season. We're heading into spring here. Just a ton of great resources to help make your place a little bit better. Hey, Matt, thanks again for being on the show. We appreciate you. We appreciate everything you do, especially for the young people. And it was great to talk to you.
Well, Nick, Lindsay, awesome to be a part of this. And, you know, continue doing what you're doing. We sure appreciate it.
All right, folks. Hey, National Deer Association, where we are united for deer.